keeping you current on all things criminal. This is Crime Feed. Crime Feed. With Darren Kevinoki and Lonnie Coombs.
Welcome to Investigation Discovery's Crime Feed podcast. I'm Darren Kevinoki.
And I'm Lonnie Coombs.
And we together are covering the ripped from the headlines cases that everybody is talking about.
And don't forget, this podcast is a weekly podcast, so be sure to come back and listen to us every week.
Yes, and don't be afraid to use Twitter. And of course, you can tweet to us at @IDCrimeFeed. Use the hashtag CrimeFeedPodcast. Or, of course, my favorite hashtag, dumbest criminals. And thank you. I've gotten several tweets, actually, with the dumbest criminals hashtag.
It's about time, Darren.
And I appreciate
it. How long has it been? That's
it, though. Too long. It's been too long since I've had a win. But thank you. Thank you, Lonnie.
You bet anytime. Hey, this first story we're talking about is a story that we've got our eyes on. A fascinating story. A very serious story. Michael Deng, 19-year-old freshman at a New York City college called Baruch. We were trying to decide how to say this. Baruch.
Baruch.
Okay.
I think if you want to
give
the Yiddish.
I'll just make sure, Darren. Yes.
With the strong sound.
Yes, thank you. Anyways, it's a college in New York City. He was attending as a freshman back in December of 2013 when he went on a trip into the Poconos Mountains out in Pennsylvania with a chapter of the Pi Delta Psi fraternity.
Yeah, but by the way, this isn't just any trip, right? This is part of their initiation rituals.
Yes, exactly.
Fraternity
initiation.
That's
exactly what it is, Darren.
Okay.
The sad thing is he that was there with some other pledges, and they were, as part of this hazing situation, they were blindfolded and forced to carry bags filled with sand while the fraternity brothers tackled them repeatedly. And apparently, as it's come out later, Michael did not really like what was happening, so he kind of fought back with some of the people who were trying to tackle him, and apparently the fraternity brothers got mad, so they hit him even harder.
And this is a ritual with, what do they call this? Because they're walking across a frozen tundra, right?
And they call this a glass ceiling. And that's what they call it, where they tackle them, they come after them. But then one of the brothers who was mad did something that they call spearing, which is essentially he took a 15-foot run up to him and speared him with his head to hit him with even more force. Threw him to the ground, and then other brothers attacked him. He was complaining of head pains, but they didn't stop. And finally, when he passed out, they took him into the house where they were staying, put him by the fire.
They didn't go to a hospital.
Not for hours. Instead, they were looking up information, Googling what to do when somebody's passed out and is not responding. They looked up how much it would cost to have an ambulance come get him, but they decided it was too expensive. And then they called the national president of the fraternity, Andy Ming.
Now, this is so interesting because, of course, the national fraternity president, who is the one who one would think would be the voice of reason,
who would be
the mature voice of wisdom guiding these young men in their decision making. What does he say when he's confronted with this factual scenario? It was something along the lines of get rid of all the evidence relating to the fraternity. So,
right.
How many times have we seen, Lonnie, that it is not the crime, it's the cover up that gets people?
Well, and the crime here was really bad because then he's finally taken the hospital hours later. And 2 days later, he actually dies from all of the injuries that he has, brain injuries and blunt force trauma to organs all over his body, head, torso, and thighs. And so...
So what are the charges here? How does this all play out?
So it ends up that five of the people, after this intensive investigation and a grand jury investigation, have been charged with murder and manslaughter and criminal conspiracy. And then 32 others, I believe, have been charged with aggravated assault and also the covering up about the crime.
And I believe conspiracy.
And the criminal conspiracy. Serious charges here.
Well, yeah, and you know, the interesting thing, though, as I read this as a defense lawyer, we've got upwards of 30 people. We've got a total of 37 defendants here, assuming that they're all brought to trial in the same trial, my goodness, where are they going to hold this trial? In a giant auditorium? Where I mean, logistically, it's going to pose some problems.
Well, you're right. In fact, the courthouse there in the Poconos is so small that they're having to bring them in a few defendants at a time because they can't actually physically contain all the defendants at once.
Right. Well, and for the audience to understand, when you've got multiple defendants that are in a trial together, you've got to have counsel tables for mm-hmm. each one of those defendants. There can be scenarios where you may even need to have multiple juries,
right?
Because sometimes evidence is introduced against one defendant and not others, and there are reasons why these things can happen. But beyond the logistical difficulties, Lonnie, I think prosecutors here actually have another problem that may be a bigger problem, which is proving exactly who did exactly what.
Yeah, and that's always a difficulty when you have a group crime essentially like this, where there's a lot of people involved. Some people might have just been standing around. Some people obviously did more than others. And already some of the defense attorneys are saying, hey, look, you know, my guy didn't do anything. But that's why the prosecutors filed this criminal conspiracy, because this is a wonderful charge that prosecutors can use in a situation like this, and essentially says that all co-conspirators are liable for the acts that are done in furtherance of the crime. So it brings everybody together under this umbrella of criminal liability.
So it's so interesting with a conspiracy is basically a criminal contract between
right.
two or more people, where two or more people agree to engage in some kind of an illegal activity. And the gist of a conspiracy, as you point out, Lonnie, is that all of the co-conspirators are liable for the actions of all the other co-conspirators. And that's how the prosecutors can cast a really, really
right.
wide net.
Essentially, because they agree to do this, and then it takes a bunch of different people to do it. And because they've all agreed to it, it's foreseeable that each one of them or some of them will go ahead and commit these crimes. The law says, we're going to hold you all liable. And there's another interesting thing. In this case, the prosecution took the case to the grand jury, because through that process, they're able to actually subpoena in these suspects and have them testify under oath. And they're able to actually get information from these insiders, the people that were involved there. And that's how we get this information. That's how we found out that he was actually objecting to what was going on, and that the brothers then fought harder against him, kind of targeted him for the worst abuse. We get that kind of information in detail and hopefully target and pinpoint exactly who did what.
Well, but let's face it, other than the guy from the National Fraternity,
who was also charged.
Who's also charged
the president,
in all this.
Yeah.
Right. Certainly not an example of good behavior, not a good job of shaping young minds and young morals. But my wondering as I look at this is that this is a college hazing incident. Nobody set out to murder this guy.
Right.
He was a potential fraternity brother of theirs. And this obviously was an unintended death. And I just wonder if this is an appropriate response to the hazing issue.
Well, I think it is. I think that hazing is a real issue on college campuses. I think we have a lot of deaths going on. And I think that instead of people just saying, this is college hazing, this is what happens, and oh, we never intended for anybody to die, wink, wink, what's happening is that people are dying. I mean, the activities that are considered to be hazing activities, you know, bond building activities, are very dangerous and deadly many times when it's done in secret, when it's done, you know, with alcohol involved. I mean, these kids here, if you want to call them kids, I mean, they're charged with concealing evidence because they're hiding any evidence of the fraternity, you know, symbols. They are charged with lying because their first reaction was to tell the police that it was just wrestling going on, when the autopsy shows that it was thousands of G-forces that had to occur to cause this type of trauma. So these are serious charges, I'll give you that. I mean, the hindering the prosecution in Pennsylvania, it's a third degree felony. They're looking at a maximum of 7 years. And in the aggravated assault, they're looking at up to 20 years in prison. So this is very serious consequences.
No question it is. I guess this, I'll just have to admit my own bias here as somebody who successfully survived the Greek system. And I had a great experience in college being the member of a fraternity. And back in those days, back in the 80s, before there was all of the sort of the political correctness that has invaded the Greek system, there was stuff that I endured that would definitely be classified as hazing. And I've got to say, maybe this just speaks to what's wrong and broken about me, Lonnie, but I look back on those experiences and frankly, I look back at them fondly.
Let me just read one thing. Sigma Alpha Epsilon, who is a famous fraternity,
yes,
for this incident,
right,
you know,
next door
drinking
to me,
and hazing,
yes,
nationwide between 2005 and 2014. Guess how many fraternity-related deaths there were in this one fraternity?
In the SAE house?
Yes. Between 2005 and 2014. Just guess.
I don't know. A dozen.
Over 60.
Wow.
Over 60. Not just injuries, deaths. So don't tell me that this is just something that people can brush under the carpet and say this only happens once in a while. It's unintended. Let's open our eyes and say, look, it may be unintended, but it's happening. Yeah. And we as the adults need to step in and say, we need to do something else.
We'll move on, but I don't know that this is going to be any cheery of a story. There's a video that's gone viral that shows a New York City street where a pit bull is attacking a man. And now the woman who is the owner of the pit bull,
Cynthia Oliver,
has been arrested. So this guy's being attacked by a pit bull. It's captured on video from above. It's an apartment that is that's on the street there. And so you see this video from above. You can hear the frantic 911 call, and people are trying to help as this man is getting attacked relentlessly by two pit
just
bulls
two.
That are attacking them. And as you say, Lonnie, the owner, who's Cynthia Oliver, she's now been arrested and has been charged with 8 counts of assault and 2 counts of reckless endangerment for allowing the pit bulls to attack this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very serious. And, you know, it's interesting because people say, well, it's the pit bulls. How is she supposed to control them or not? A lot of details are coming out right now. First, the police were saying that she sicked the dogs on the victim. And the victim actually said, no, that's not true. She was actually trying to pull the dogs off. But then there's some other reports that some witnesses said there was actually an argument between the victim and the dog owner. Yeah, and that she then took the dogs off the leash.
Yeah, so how the dogs get off the leash,
right,
is what
I want
to know.
So that the dogs could get to the victim. Someone else said, well, the victim was trying to, you know, pet the dogs, and so that's why the dogs attacked. So there are a number of different issues about exactly how did this occur, and all of these little details are really important to figure out because it goes to the liability for dog bites.
Right. So let's talk about this, that when it comes to dog bites, the laws will vary from state to state. And there are two basic theories that that will prevail depending on what state that you're in. Some states are what they call a strict liability state, meaning if you own a dog and that dog bites somebody or causes damages, you as the owner are strictly liable, meaning we don't care whether you were negligent, we don't care whether you did everything right, you could have had a muzzle on that dog, whatever it is. If your dog injures somebody, then you are strictly liable, meaning you are on the hook for any injuries. Other states, though, look at it differently. And historically, there's something called the one bite rule, which basically means that you as a dog owner get one free bite. Well,
right.
Not you. Your dog gets one free bite,
yeah.
Where until your dog bites somebody, you're not put on notice that you've got a dangerous dog. So the first person that your dog bites.
One free bite.
You don't have the liability until now you know. Now, once you know. Once your dog bites somebody in those one bite states, now you better watch out, because if your dog bites somebody else, then you're really in trouble. But New York actually does it a little bit differently.
Yeah, it's sort of a hybrid, a mix between the strict liability and the one bite law. But let me just go back for one thing, Darren, before we go into that. This dog, apparently, according to the neighbors, Cynthia Oliver's dogs, they say that these dogs actually killed 3 other dogs just this summer. That the neighbors all know how dangerous they are, and if they see them, that they'll go to the other side of the street. So talk about being put on notice as an owner to the dangerous propensity of your own dog.
Well, if that's true, that would be a bad set of facts. If I'm representing Cynthia Oliver, those are exactly the kind of facts that I do not want to hear.
And we all remember the San Francisco pit bull mauling case back in 2001, the victim, Diane Whipple, who was just carrying her groceries home in her apartment building, and these two pit bulls who were owned by her neighbors came out and attacked her and ended up killing her. And in this case, it was the first time the prosecutors actually went after not only an involuntary manslaughter charge, but also a second-degree murder charge, saying that there was some intent here.
That case, what was so interesting to me about that case at the time is, even though the facts occurred in San Francisco, they actually brought that case down to Los Angeles, didn't they?
Yeah, they had to try it. There was a change of venue motion that was granted. But what was interesting is they did actually convict one of the owners of the second-degree murder charge, and it went up and down in the appeals courts, and finally, the second-degree murder conviction was upheld. They said that the defendant did act with conscious disregard for danger to human life because she knew how dangerous her pit bulls were and how aggressive, and they upheld her 15-to-life sentence. So.
Wow. So to me, I wonder, just looking at the story that we're talking about today, that viral video with the pit bull attack and then the San Francisco mauling case with the pit bull attack, the common thread, the common denominator in these cases are pit bulls.
Yeah.
So my wondering, Lonnie, is this a breed that needs special laws, or are these pit bulls the unfortunate subjects of fear-based discrimination because we as a society are inappropriately targeting these pit bulls?
Well, you know, you can say inappropriately. The reason people are so afraid of pit bulls is because they have this classic locked jaw. So once they get a hold of you, and they lock their jaw and they shake you, and that's why you end up with dead people, because the injuries are so bad from the way their jaw is built. But back in 2012, actually back in 2007, a little boy, 10-year-old boy in Maryland named Dominic Soleski, was mauled and almost killed. And in essentially one of these mauling cases. And it was such a horrible case. And it was seriously, the doctor said it was a miracle that the little boy lived, that they started legislation pinpointing the pit bulls, as you said. And they essentially wrote a law that said, if there's a pit bull, then owners are automatically put on notice of how dangerous their dog is. And so we're going to hold them responsible for that. Well, this one went up and down also in the courts and said, look, pit bulls by nature are essentially mutts. And so how are owners going to necessarily be held liable if they don't know if their dog's a pit bull or how much percentage has to be a pit bull, et cetera? And so then they just went back to essentially saying, look, if we want to do this, just do strict liability for all dogs. And that way you can't say, well, it's because they have a pit bull or not a pit bull. If a dog is dangerous or if your dog ends up hurting somebody, you're going to be held liable.
Well, personally, I'm the victim of dog bites on a daily basis. I have too many Pomeranians.
Yes, I'm sure those are so dangerous.
They actually have their own Twitter feed at Willis and Cash, and so you can see photos of them there. But they are they have razor sharp teeth. But seriously though, what could people do?
I found a really fascinating statistic in here. I mean, they do say, you know, make sure if you have dogs, any kind of dog, make sure you have insurance to cover anything any animal liability. Make sure they're properly trained, that they get exercise, keep them on a leash, and then as Bob Barker used to always say, spray and neuter your dogs. Here's a fascinating statistic. 97% of dogs involved in fatal dog attacks back in 2006 were not spayed or neutered.
Wow.
So, that's something to consider, to make sure that your dog is safe and that they're not, going out and attacking other people.
Be a responsible pet owner. But understand this, and I think the point about insurance is a good one.
Yeah.
Understand that even though the laws may vary from state to state, you as a pet owner, there's always some theory of liability where you could be on the hook. So be careful, be responsible.
Here's a really sad story. This is a story about a little 3-year-old who was taken to the park by her mother, Jer Donnell Lee, and her mother was Romishia Sims. And apparently the mother took the little boy to the park on May 20th at 11:15 a.m. And then May 22nd in the morning, 2 days later, someone noticed that they were still there. This is in Maryland. And so they called the police, and the police went out to check on the mother and the baby, and they noticed that the baby was actually dead. And they put together that
such a horrific story.
It's so sad that the little boy had been there on the swing for 2 full days, during which time at nighttime it had gone down to 51 degrees. And when they did the autopsy, they found out that he had died of dehydration and hypothermia. No other trauma, though. Very fascinating. Only the dehydration and hypothermia. And it actually ended up, though, they filed against the mother first-degree manslaughter charges, a child abuse charge, and she's being held on $150,000 bond. And what's fascinating is the father of the child came forward and said that he had been fighting since March to remove their son from Sims' care because he had been concerned about the safety. He said that Sims had been in a mental hospital a couple of times, that she reported suffered from depression and bipolar disorder, and that at one point she thought that people were trying to kill her or her son. And so she took the son and ended up jumping out of a cab.
She's got a history of mental health problems.
But when they went to the court to hear about this, the judge said, how are you feeling? And she said, I've got things under control. And so the judge went ahead and gave the son back to the mom on the regular custody schedule they had, where the mom had the son during the week and the father had the son on the weekend.
Well, in this case where now this woman is being prosecuted for the death of her child, clearly we're dealing with somebody who's got mental health problems, right? There's no debate about that. So the glaring issue is going to be sanity, or we can expect an insanity defense. But, you know, there may also be other issues about her competency to stand trial. And I think this is just an interesting legal point for people to appreciate. The insanity defense relates to what is the condition of the defendant at the time that the crime occurred. And basically, insanity relates to the inability to understand and appreciate right from wrong, where you don't even get that the conduct you're engaged in is wrongful conduct, which, frankly, when it comes to pushing a child on a swing that long, I'm immediately thinking this may be one of those cases where the insanity defense really is righteous. But the other issue is competency to stand trial. Because if somebody can't appreciate what's going on around them in trial and they can't assist their attorney in the defense, then they may not even be competent to stand trial.
Right. And I think it's important for people to remember that those, you know, when they talk about, oh, the person was insane or they're not competent, those are two totally different things. You're talking about totally different time frames. And the whether they're insane or not really goes to, is there a defense? And the defense would be not guilty by reason of insanity, which then leads to a commitment into a mental hospital.
Right.
Whereas if you're found not competent, that means you're not capable of actually going through trial.
And your trial gets put off until competency is restored.
They're able to essentially medicate you to the point where you're, you know, rational enough to be able to understand what's going on in your trial.
But what's interesting on the insanity defense, because I think, you know, looking ahead into the crystal ball, it's not a stretch to say that's what's going to be coming down here. I think the people at large, the public at large, thinks that the insanity defense is something that's used a lot and is successful a lot. And statistically, though, we see that it's only used in 1% of the cases, and it's only successful about 25% of the time when it is used.
Yeah.
So it really is, it's really not that frequent of an occurrence.
Right. In the history of the insanity defense, you know, back before 1984, there was this many different versions, but essentially the diminished capacity diversion version, which would be where the defendant would say, hey, well, I was crazy at the time. And then the prosecution had to prove that they were sane at the time of the crime. Well, in 1984, after John Hinckley, tried to assassinate Reagan, there was this whole big, you know, outcry about it. And so they changed the laws, essentially, and they put the burden to prove the insanity on the defendant. They made it harder for the defendant to start claiming this defense.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because there's very few places in the criminal justice system where the defense has a burden to prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, the burden's on the prosecution to prove to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is the person that did it. The two exceptions that leap to mind is when there's an argument about bail and pretrial release. Mm-hmm. That's one of those circumstances where the judge, when they're deciding the case, will actually presume that the defendant is guilty and then fix bail in an amount that's necessary to secure their appearance and to safeguard the community. And then the other place is here where we're talking about insanity, where if the defense is going to be insanity, then the burden is on the defense to produce evidence. And the standard, by the way, is going to vary from state to state. And it's also different under the federal system, the burden of proof. Because in California, for example, it's preponderance of the evidence that the defendant needs to introduce evidence of insanity, but it's just got to be tipping the scales.
More, right.
50% plus a feather.
Whereas the federal, it's clear and convincing, which is higher than the,
exactly,
than the preponderance.
Exactly. Yeah. So interesting. You know, one of the things that strikes me just in how sad this whole thing is, no one has to take a test before they procreate.
Right.
You know, we've got to jump through more hoops to get a driver's license than we do to be able to have kids. And it's just so frustrating, where especially like here, you had a woman who had a previous brush with the justice system, where the justice system had the opportunity to intervene and say, hey, wait a second, we really don't think that you should be parenting this child. That opportunity was either missed or the judge made the right call, but now we've got a child who's dead as the result, and it's just so... Ugh.
Yeah, and those calls by the judges in that situation of who should have custody and based on what, I mean, other than the mental illness, it appears that this mother was very devoted and loved her child and had a support system. The father was involved, her mother, the grandmother was involved, but now she's facing very serious charges. The manslaughter charge, she's looking at a maximum of 10 years in prison. The child abuse charge, because there was a death involved, could be up to 30 years in prison. So, Darren, what do you think is the appropriate solution here for her?
Look, I don't think it's just sending her off to state prison. And I know from having spoken to clients of mine and other folks that have gone to prison, unless a person on their own is highly self-motivated to make changes in their life, they're just not going to get the kind of mental health treatment that they need. And I think it's important for people to appreciate that when the insanity defense is successfully mounted, that it doesn't give the person a free pass, that they end up being committed to a mental hospital until a judge deems them to be sane.
But that's the scary part, is that it could be in a year, it could be in a month, it could be in 20 years. You just don't know how long it's going to take.
You don't. But for me, looking at the facts of this case, this is a woman that needs treatment and not simply to be warehoused with a bunch of dangerous folks where she's not going to get the help that she needs.
But that's important. A lot of people say, why did the prosecutor even charge her? Well, you don't have any control or any ability to take over and say, look, you need to get this treatment and somehow be able to oversee it, unless there is a prosecution that is started and initiated that gives them the jurisdiction.
It's
to do
the
that.
Only way to get power over them.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? It's so jarring to say, well, let's move on to something that's a little bit lighter.
These
but
were heavy, heavy cases this week.
Let's talk about some dumb criminals.
Okay.
And, you know, people who have been listening to our podcast know that in the battle between Lonnie and I going mano a mano, that, I've been bested. I don't have a strong track record here, but this week, Lonnie, I feel like I actually have something.
Okay.
So why don't you go first?
Okay. Mine's very simple. Joey Miller and Matthew McNally decided that they wanted to commit a crime. They were going to break into an apartment. So they did realize that it's an important and a good thing to somehow try to disguise your appearance.
Yes, disguises are good.
Yes, but they didn't use a mask. They didn't get a ski mask. They didn't use a stocking. They didn't even put on a baseball cap or anything like that.
Fake mustache?
No, something even better than the fake mustache. They took permanent markers... and they drew masks on their face. That was their big disguise. They drew the masks on their face, which, as you know, permanent markers is really hard to erase.
Yeah, yeah. So, underscore the word permanent.
Yeah, so when they were pulled over by the police after they kind of bungled the break-in, hey, they weren't able to pull those masks off and pretend like they were innocent. They were stuck with the masks drawn onto their face. They were very easy to identify.
I got to see those mug shots. That's hilarious.
They got the nickname Dumb and Dumber by the arresting cops, by the way.
I got to say that that's a good one. I don't know. I guess we'll have to leave it up to the Twittersphere to see if I can do any better. But let's try this. So there's a gentleman down in Long Beach. His name was James Elliott. And James decided that he wanted to engage in a little robbery. So, and it actually turned into an attempted murder.
Oh.
At the time of the robbery, he had a 38 caliber revolver, which he fired at his intended victim, or I should say attempted to fire. The gun did not go off.
Thank heavens.
So what did our protagonist do?
What?
Mr. Elliott was puzzled by this. So he turned the gun around, peered down the barrel to see what was wrong, and he tried the trigger again.
And did it work?
This time it worked.
Nice.
He survived, but he shot himself. You know, let that be a lesson to all you would-be robbers out there. Keep the barrel pointed away from you? Is that the takeaway?
I don't know what the takeaway is.
I don't know.
So the takeaway is there's always dumbest criminals out there.
So I guess the battle between the dumb criminal is it the ones with the permanent marker or the one who peers down the barrel of a gun and shoots himself
in the face?
We'll leave it up to you out there, audience, and be sure vote on Twitter at ID Crime Feed, and of course use the hashtags Crime Feed Podcast, and for this, the hashtag Dumbest Criminals.
I'm Lonnie Coombs, and remember, if you want more shocking true crime stories, watch Investigation Discovery or visit crimefeed.com.
I'm Darren Cavanocchi. Thanks for listening. We'll see you at Crime Feed, and thank you.
Keeping you current on all things criminal, Crime Feed.
Crime Feed.
With Darren Cavanocchi and Lonnie Coombs.